Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 159 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Let me introduce my three fellow geeks. First up is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Well, I've recovered from AirVenture, so I should be awake for the entire show.
I hope so. We won't have to poke you like last week.
Yes.
Also with us is Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog.
Hey, good evening, Max, David, supported others. Good to be here.
And it's good to have you. Also with us, of course, is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hi, folks. Hi, guys. Another Sunday night. Guess what we're doing?
Here we are. Our guest this episode is Pat Flanagan. Pat's a professional airline pilot in the U.S. He's also an aviation blogger at aviationchatter.com, and he's also a licensed flight instructor. Pat, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
Is there such a thing as a non-licensed flight instructor?
Sure.
I just wondered.
The famous rogue flight instructors.
Ah, yes. Okay. Yes, I was just curious.
So, Pat, what kind of instruction do you give?
These days I'm pretty much stuck under the airline contract, so I can't charge for instruction anymore. Uh-huh. Yeah. I'm schooled by the CRJ these days.
Very good. And just a quick question. How long have you been writing Aviation Chatter?
2.5 years.
Ah. So what's more fun, flying or writing Aviation Chatter?
Flying, easily.
Okay.
But by the way, before we get into this, Pat, can I say, you have a good pilot voice.
Soothing, right?
Like if we have if I'm on your flight and we have a 2.5 hour tarmac delay, I feel comfortable.
You feel comfortable.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, that is good.
Unfortunately, we all get a lot of practice doing that.
Yeah, I imagine. All right, coming up, we've got a bit of aviation news from the past week. We're going to talk with Pat about Aviation Chatter and some other topics. We've got David's This Week in Aviation History segment. I'm not sure if we have an Australia desk report this week.
I don't think we do. Something about the contract or something, and they didn't think they needed to do anything anymore.
You know, there is an Aus desk representative here. We can do an Australia desk.
Well, no, actually, I believe your deal is only authorized as a one-way code share. So, fa-bam!
Oh, yeah. And we've got Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment, and we're going to finish that up with a little bit of listener mail. Why don't we get started right away, guys, with some aviation news. Our first story comes from Flight Global. This is Cirrus loses access to Vision Jet prototype. It's an article written by Stephen Trimble. And Stephen says, Cirrus has lost access to its Vision SF-50 jet prototype over concerns about the export status of the Williams FJ-33 engine following the company's acquisition by a Chinese company. We see that the U.S. State Department is looking to determine whether design data in that engine can be shared with a foreign-owned company. Whoops.
Doesn't make any sense to me, though.
No?
To be honest. The background, of course, on the Williams company is that they started out building engines for cruise missiles. So there's a lot of history of some pretty cool, I'm sure, top secret stuff in their bag. But the Williams engines on the Cirrus Vision Jet are available on other airplanes that are already living in China. If I'm not mistaken, the CJ-4 has almost the same version number of the Williams engines that the Vision Jet is going to have. My guess is there's something else to this story that we don't know, but this whole thing just doesn't make sense to me. If they wanted the technology, they could go buy a Citation or CJ-4, tear the engines down, and figure out how it worked, I would think.
Yeah, but I mean,
unless they're sharing some kind of drawings or something with them, that might be another story, I guess.
Well, I really, obviously, I'm going to plead massive ignorance on GA, but this does seem like, either way, this does just appear to be some kind of requisite State Department step. So I don't want to theorize. it's too much, but it just seems like an export control issue more than anything. But what I did find interesting, however, is that depending on how the ruling goes, this could force a re-engining of the Cirrus jet, though.
Yeah, worst case scenario, I guess that's a possibility.
But I don't want to try to make too... It does seem like a required regulatory step.
Export control regulations can be kind of tricky. There's really two departments, U.S. departments of government, that are involved in export control regulations. There's the Department of Commerce, which is mentioned in the article, which has the Export Administration Regulations, which is fondly referred to as the EAR. And then there's also the Department of State has the ITAR requirements, which is the International Traffic in Arms Regulations. And, you know, both of these are kind of tricky to navigate. And, you know, there's some things that can trip you up, but you have to make sure that before you export any kind of technology, technical data, you know, whatever, that you have to satisfy both those requirements. Now, a review may show that there are no requirements, or it may show that there's requirements that they obtain a license in order to export this, but it remains to be seen. The other thing I would say about export control is to effect an export doesn't mean that something has to leave the country. If there's an item or there's technical data associated with that engine and a Chinese national in the U.S. walks by it in the Cirrus shop or in the Williams shop, that's an export. That's called a deemed export. Cirrus and Williams, and anybody else who's thinking about doing business in China, aviation or otherwise, really needs to pay a lot of attention to the ITAR and the EAR before, you know, going down that path.
The one thing that interests me, I'm sure we could get into a very long podcast about export control. How this works in a situation where, like, for example, at CFM, where you have a U.S. company and a foreign company collaborating, how that all works out. I'm guessing it could probably get messy. I think back in the day, McDonnell Douglas did have some production in China, right?
Yeah, these kinds of things can be allowable, but you just have to have the proper export license.
It probably just get messy regulatory-wise sometimes.
Yeah, there's a lot of hoops you have to jump through, and you just have to make sure that you satisfy all the regulations, because the penalty, the downside, is very large. I mean, if it turns out that there's technical data in that engine under either the EAR or the ITAR, and an export has occurred, there's fines, you can be barred from further exports. The penalties can be fairly severe, so you have to make sure you get it right. And I'm sure that's what Cirrus and Williams are doing now. At least I hope so.
It's kind of like being married.
Yeah, well, you know, I find this interesting, because all this is coming down on the Williams engine as a result of the Chinese firm buying Cirrus aircraft, right?
Yes.
Williams is their own separate company. The only thing they have to do with Cirrus is the fact that they're putting that engine inside of the airplane.
Kind of. I mean, if there is technical data or export-controlled items in that engine, then even though it's Cirrus that's entering into a relationship with the Chinese, if the owner of that data or those items is aware that the end use involves an export, then they're accountable for that. So that's probably why Williams is, and they're probably holding onto the plane, because they realize that if they botch this with the Department of State or the Department of Commerce, they're the guys that are on the hook. Okay, let's move on. Next story comes from Air Transport World. Congress finds compromise to end FAA partial shutdown. Now, we've talked in the past about the fact that U.S. Congress failed to provide funding for the FAA, so they were operating under a partial shutdown. The article says a bipartisan compromise between the House of Representatives Republicans and Senate Democrats was brokered to end the partial shutdown of the FAA. Says that this sort of brokered compromise includes cuts to the Essential Air Service program on the one side, but also Ray LaHood gets to use the power of the office, the transportation secretary, to grant some waivers to some rural airports that would have been affected by these subsidy cuts. Probably the biggest public effect of this whole thing has been with the inability of the FAA to collect taxes on airfares and how the airlines have been responding to that.
Well, here's the thing that I'm horribly disappointed about. They've passed this. That's great. Okay, we've got the FAA funded again. it's a temporary extension. That's the thing that that people are constantly missing. It only lasts until September 16th.
Then they've got to do it again.
Yeah, they didn't solve anything. They pushed it off for 1 month, and then it's right back into it.
Yeah, and that's because both sides said, okay, look, this is really embarrassing, and let's get this whole EAS thing dealt with later. In the meantime, let's just get them back to work, and then we'll figure this out. And I mean, and they had, I wish I could think of the parliamentary term that they used to make the deal. It was, because I mean, all these people were gone. The Senate and the House were all gone. And I know when I was talking to some of these folks in Washington, I said, well, what are they going to do? How are they going to get these people back? They're going to bring all these senators back to get this. And I wish I, something
well, there's something, this unanimous consent.
Right.
Thing.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's the phrase I was looking for. Yeah. Right. And it means essentially that I don't know how it works, but they didn't have to actually come back. They could all just.
Yeah. Kind of vote
say,
from where they were.
Well, apparently, I guess when the roll is called in the Senate, someone is there to present the legislation, and the clerk says something about, is there a unanimous consent option open or something like that? Mm-hmm. And then the guy says, yeah, actually. And they'll say, anybody opposed to that? And of course, nobody's opposed because there's nobody there. And that's how it got through. But it was, it's nauseating. And as Pat said, I mean, this is, we're going to be back at this after Labor Day again.
Well, to be honest, I mean, I'm glad we have a short-term extension.
Yeah, because we needed something.
And that's where all the associations were headed on Wednesday and Thursday. I mean, saying that, okay, look, we should have the FAA completely reauthorized the way it's supposed to be. However, as much as we've complained about short-term agreements, we could live with a short-term for now. I mean, and so they've just, they just keep reducing what they expect, and they're never disappointed.
Can I ask a really stupid question? We lost how much in revenue from not collecting taxes?
Exactly.
And over my $400 million.
And my sister-in-law's comment to me tonight at dinner was, who gets that money?
Well, that's very, yes, because the airlines, or at least a lot of them, raised fares by the amount of the tax that the FAA couldn't lawfully collect. So the net effect of ticket prices was zero, but the airlines enjoyed this giant windfall as a result. I mean, do you think that's right?
Well, that's what I mean. So when's the lawsuit going to be? There's got to be some lawyer out there that's going to say, well, this wasn't constant. This wasn't right. This wasn't fair, because people who were supposed to fly those weeks paid that tax months ago. Am I right?
Yes.
So therefore,
and no refund for them.
There's no refund for them. And basically, they were paying the airlines to have committed false advertising, because they were told the person when they bought that ticket said they were paying X whatever fee.
Yeah.
And now the airlines is just absconding with it?
This was very confusing this week. And actually, we actually saw a news release from Delta, and I don't remember the exact text, but there was some guidance out from the IRS saying that we could see some tax refunds for people who flew during this tax holiday and had prepaid. And so people were expecting that there would be a refund, and there are still some questions on exactly how that'd be processed, because the airline still, has your form of payment, so they could process it or perhaps do a claim of the refund on your tax return. But then the IRS updated its page on Friday, and according to their latest guidance, the taxes were made retroactive. So if you flew during that holiday period, your tax still goes. However, there will not be any collection of back taxes. So if you booked a ticket during this time period, during the tax holiday, you will not be charged taxes. But the airlines got some extra revenue from this. I forget the Southwest actually gave an estimate in their earnings call this past week, and actually the number escapes me at this moment, but it was in the millions. I think it was a combination of both, and this is just me guessing, but also because Alaska mentioned this in a press last week. Oh, this past week. I think it was a combination of higher volumes, but also the higher fares. That's just my guess. Yeah, I what was kind of funny is the I think the champion of the consumer that actually came out is Spirit Airlines, which I mean,
the bottom line is I want my refund because I flew the airlines during that time.
Yeah, you will not be getting a refund based on the you will not. Sorry.
That's where that's it stands now.
Is it based on when you flew or when you booked your ticket?
If you had purchased your ticket, like let's say in May, June, and you ended up flying during the time the taxes were expired, you would have been getting a refund. That did not, but based on the latest guidance from the IRS, that will not be.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Not going to happen. I can actually can quote it directly. This is from August 5th, so Friday. Today's congressional action extending the FAA authorization reinstates retroactively the airline ticket taxes for passengers who travel during the time lapse of the FAA's authorization.
It's retroactive. Does that mean that the airlines have to pony up?
Well, that's what I hope. I don't mind not getting a refund, but damn well that United better not get that tax money.
This whole thing is messy. It's been moving fast, so don't. While we're on a podcast, don't quote me on this, even though we're. But I'm not sure if this is accurate. But David, what you paid will be going to the Treasury as far. Well, not the Treasury, but will be going to it. Well, the tax revenue will be going through. However, during the past week, when the taxes were expired, the airlines will be keeping that money. Is based on how I'm reading the situation.
I haven't seen any evidence of the consumer, the flying public, complaining about any of this. Have you seen anything?
Hey, what am I? I'm the flying public.
Okay, other than David.
well, I think there have been some complaints about the fare increase that resulted, which, to be honest, I think is justified. I think actually Spirit, during their earnings call, their CEO said something along the lines of, you know, this was never our money. The consumer should have it. That's just a paraphrase. But so I can definitely see the criticism there, though. Generally speaking, I mean, the out of pocket price for the consumer really did not change. So.
Right. The net for the consumer was zero. Just a matter of the money went to the airline instead of to the government.
Exactly.
Did the rates go down again?
You know what? I have not.
Yeah, that's
I
a very not, good question, David.
This is gas prices. They go way up, but they never really come back down to where they were. So,
well, no, airfares can drop and change very, very quickly. And actually, same thing with gas prices. I mean, it's completely based on the market. So I think that's an unfair characterization.
All right, let's push forward. A little bit of military news. This comes from the Warner Robins Patriot. This is F-35s join F-22s in stand-down mode. This article says, an integrated power package, or IPP failure, at Edwards Air Force Base has grounded all 20 F-35 joint strike fighters. David, what's an integrated power package?
I'm going to rely on Dan's former boss, Stephen Trimble. He actually wrote a really good article, A Short History of the Subsystem. The IPP is a, according to him, a 200-horsepower gas turbine engine that powers the electrical system to start the aircraft. And then it powers the coolant and air conditioning system. So we have another fifth-generation fighter that is trying to suffocate its pilots.
Not a good thing.
No. So,
hence the move to pilotless aircraft.
Aircraft.
Oh, here we go. Yeah.
So now we've got 20 F-35s grounded indefinitely until they figure out what's wrong with this IPP. And that supplements the 100-plus F-22s that are grounded because they still haven't figured out why the carbon monoxide scrubbing system is still failing and suffocating its pilots. As far as fifth-generation fighters go right now, my money is on the Chinese and the Soviets, I mean the Russians, since they don't seem to have these problems that we do. It's a simple thing to quote Star Trek, Scotty once said, "Aye, Captain, the more they put in the plumbing, the easier it is to clog it up." So, I mean, right now we've got a lot of fighters that can't fly because they have annoying air conditioning problems.
So what's the impact of that? What does that mean to the capability of the Air Force these days?
We have F-15s and F-16s that can still shoot down the majority of the world's aircraft.
I mean, it's clearly not a good thing, but it's...
It's not a good thing. It's an embarrassing thing. It's not surprising with the F-35 because it's in low-rate initial production, or LRIP. And there's only 20 aircraft in the whole inventory that are flying. And they're still in test mode. The F-22, though, is a frontline, no longer in production aircraft that shouldn't have these problems. And the last major conflict where they might have been used, they weren't. They were F-16s and F-15s were used. So it's really just sort of an embarrassment for the Air Force that the air dominance fighter, the aircraft that supposedly has changed the world, has been grounded since late April, early May, with no resolution in sight. The F-22 does not have a two-seater, nor does it have anything comparable that you can get flight time in. So all of those F-22 pilots are cruising around the skies in T-38s. A T-38 does not have the same flight parameters as F-22. So we have almost now 4 or 5 months worth of pilots who have not had proper stick time in the aircraft that they're supposed to fly in case of combat. And those skills are rapidly, if you don't use them, you lose them.
You get some atrophy there. So, yeah, that's a very interesting point.
So there's probably not much of a chance the bad guys are going to come after us because the 22s and the 35s don't run, right?
No, because there's these things called Hornets, Eagles, and Fighting Falcons, or Vipers, that pretty much could do the job.
Yeah. Where did this Viper thing come from? We were talking about that somewhere on Twitter last week. I'd never heard it called the Viper before.
It's been called the Viper since day one. Originally, General Dynamics wanted to name the aircraft the Viper. At the time, there was this small little television show called Battlestar Galactica. And Battlestar Galactica put a trademark on the term Viper. So the next best thing was Falcon. And Rob, believe it or not, I believe you know of a company that has a trademark on the word Falcon. So it became
the Ford?
Yeah, there you go, Ford. So then it became the...
Ford. They had a Falcon?
They did. But that would be the Dassault Corporation.
Yes, you're right.
And so they named it, the Air Force named it the dumbest name in the world, the Fighting Falcon.
As opposed to the Lazy Falcon.
They could have just called it the Millennium Falcon and it would have been fine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that would have worked. No doubt about it.
So the pilots have always called it the Viper.
All right, let's finish up with an item from The Street. This is U.S. Airways and pilots clash on slowdown. And this article says U.S. Airways has sued its pilots union, contending that an escalating safety campaign is actually an illegal job action that has harmed the airline and its passengers through an increasing number of flight delays, missed connections, and mishandled bags. Well, the APA, the Airline Pilots Association, responds saying accusations that U.S. APA is involved with any sort of illegal job action are categorically false.
U.S. Airways and their pilots, specifically the U.S. Airways East pilots, it's an interesting story. And I guess the Cliff Notes version, and Pat or Rob can correct me if I'm wrong, but basically it's been a mess for, we'll say, I think roughly 6 years now. Back in the day, when U.S. Airways and America West were still separate, both pilot groups were represented by ALPA, which is the Airline Pilots Association, which I believe is the largest pilots union in the world, though Rob can correct me if I'm wrong.
Correct, Amondo.
But basically, so as I'm sure Pat can attest, seniority is very important for a pilot. And there were some issues with the some pilots had issues with the way seniority list integration was being handled at US Airways and America West, and eventually got to the point where this new independent union, USAPA, was voted in to represent the pilots, and they mainly, I think it'd be fair to say, mainly represent the interests of the US Airways East pilots, which was a bigger labor group, and there's basically been a big legal battle between the East and the West pilots over the past few years about, well, is USAPA really fair? I don't want to get in. I'm not a labor law expert, but basically, you know, is this union fairly representing the interests of the pilots? And it's just been a huge, huge mess.
What's the difference between this East West thing? What distinguishes?
East is your traditional US Airways pilots. West refers to the ex-America West pilots.
Oh, okay.
So they've been infighting, which obviously, if your pilots are infighting, that's kind of not really great for contract negotiations. So US Airways is alleging that USAPA, or USAPA, however the heck you want to say it, is in this illegal work slowdown that's basically under the guise of, well, make sure you know you fly safe, which is just allegedly disrupting the U.S. Airways operations, specifically in Charlotte, which is their biggest hub. And the Cranky Flyer actually posted some stuff from the briefs supporting this injunction. An interesting statistic, basically saying that U.S. Airways is claiming that, well, if you look at these operational metrics in terms of things like taxi times or also, you know, maintenance write-ups by pilots, the operations by U.S. Airways West pilots have basically remained unchanged, but these metrics have worsened with U.S. Airways East pilots, and I think also for the taxi times they mentioned, you know, we've noticed no change in U.S. Airways Express operations either. So they're saying that at least part of USAPA is engaged in some kind of coordinated slowdown to, I basically put the screw to management. The lawsuit has some apparent text messages that were sent out to East pilots that were pretty harsh. So, for example, Cranky Flyer quotes one of these text messages that was sent out that was in one of the legal documents saying, seems like we have our first winner for the Company Suck-Up Award, Pink Panty Award, or whatever you want to call it. This A330 captain on reserve on July 15th had one day available. Suddenly, on July 16th, he is on a Frankfurt three-day trip. Congratulations go to, whatever the name was, as our first winner. Keep up the good work by screwing all your fellow pilots that are trying to get a contract we deserve. If you have a good reason, please let everyone know. And granted, I may not be, I'm not going to claim to be a labor expert, but this just seems so messed up. Because A, you're asking for a contract, but B, the pilots are still busy fighting each other legally. So that kind of screws up contract negotiations. And basically at this point, I'd be willing to say that the U.S. Airways East pilots, and you could say if they're just, you could debate if they're justified or not, really were the ones that were angry about this whole seniority thing in the first place. So really, at this point, all this infighting and everything is basically, by keeping this old labor contract, is helping U.S. Airways preserve a labor cost advantage versus other carriers at bankruptcy wages. So the whole thing just seems so messed up to me. It's just, it's not even...
And you should see the very large billboard that lives just down the street from me.
Oh, yeah? What does it say?
It's for the U.S. Airways pilot union about the fact that they don't have a contract yet. There's one at either end of the airport so that anyone sees as they go into the airport.
Okay, I have a question for Pat.
Sure, shoot.
When there's labor activity like this going on, do pilots in other airlines pay attention and watch it with great interest?
You know, it's kind of wide and varied. You've got the industry insiders who watch it very closely, and they're all about every single airline's union disputes and all that, and they could probably go all day about this specific issue. For the most part, it's kind of, we're focused on our own thing, and we get the flyer, for example, you know, I'm unioned with ALPA over here, and I get the little emailer, and I look through it every now and then, but it's not a big concern, because I'm sorry to say it, but it doesn't directly affect the airline pilot working for a different airline. Now, that being said, though, when there are picketing events, the airlines, not only various different airline unions, air traffic control unions, all these people do show up and support the other pilots when things are really getting down to the nitty gritty.
So there's solidarity when it's important.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes. So I think, for example, like other ALPA airline pilots came and supported. I'm Pat would know better than I would, but I think there were some ALPA pilots who were helping with the Spirit strike last year, for example.
Yeah, there absolutely were.
It's not like that all the time, because I mean, if you go back to some of the strikes decades ago when labor had a lot more solidarity, even. I mean, I look at the United had a strike in I don't know, 85, I think, or something like that, and those people at United, some of them were so vehemently pro ALPA, and then you had lots of other people that said, you know, I don't know, I really don't care that much. It's that silent majority that made things very difficult, because the minority guys, to this day, if there are any of the people that crossed the picket line during that 85 strike, they still know who they are. The early list of the guys that crossed the picket line and took the jobs at Eastern, which was, I don't know, Dan, you're the airline history. I don't know, when was that? Back in the, you know, the early 80s. I mean, there were people, I remember going to job interviews, and they would ask me if I'd ever flown for Eastern. And at one point I asked why, and they said, well, because we got to check the list. Because if your name's on the list, you're screwed. You're not going anywhere. Yeah. But it's not like that anymore.
That I think both the airlines and the unions are constantly looking at other carriers. I mean, obviously every airline wants to make sure their labor costs are competitive. So for a big industry issue like scope clause relief, of course all the airlines, and obviously ALPA or APA or whoever, is going to be closely watching that as well.
Scope is critical to everybody. If the negotiation goes poorly for one airline, it will affect your airline next time your negotiations come up.
Well, that's going to be a very, very big issue with the United Continental pilots, just because the scope clauses, by the way, if anyone doesn't know, it's basically a part of the pilot contract that sort of establishes how much regional flying can be. A big part of it is how much regional flying can be done. And United has a very liberal scope clause, I think it's fair to say, with all these CRJ-700s and E-170s flying around. Continental, all they got is Q-400s. So, and that's because they have no 70-seat jets, and that's because of the scope clause. So it's a big issue.
Yeah, but think of the experiences that the United Continental people will have to work with. I mean, on the one hand, you have the America West U.S. Airways deal and how that has gone in the tank. I mean, imagine if you were a U.S. Airways stockholder. But then you had the Delta Northwest deal where they said, you know what, guys? Before we say this deal is done, let's get this damn contract thing ironed out. And that has gone really very, very smoothly. And then you see the United folks going, we've kind of got this, as you said, this liberal scope clause, and the Continental people are saying, yeah, but that's not the way we do it. And you could almost see this stuff coming.
The last thing I'll say is, if you just want to look at it from a scope perspective, Delta and Northwest, I'd argue, had much more comparable, I don't know the exact numbers, much more comparable scope clauses than United Continental. But also, this is obviously very much a two-sided issue. Obviously, I don't know enough to really judge Delta versus United here, but obviously you need a management team that's eager and willing to negotiate to make this all work.
Once again, we're here with Pat Flanagan from aviationchatter.com. Hey, Pat.
Hi.
Tell our listeners what they can find at Aviation Chatter.
Sure. Aviationchatter.com. It's a blog I've been running for about 2.5 years now. It started off focusing mostly on flying tips, flight training, but I take it beyond the normal, you know, this is how to do a steep turn stuff that's been done before. I focus on a lot of those lessons that I've learned in my 15 years flying airplanes that my instructor never taught me. and I've gotten a pretty good response from that. Recently, I've completely redesigned the site, and I'm starting to move towards aviation product reviews, iPhone, iPad app reviews, and I've even gotten a great opportunity, thanks to Cessna, to go to Wichita, and I reviewed the Skycatcher. I checked out the Citation 10. I'm going to Jabiru later this month to do the very same.
Oh, fantastic. Wait, when you say aviation products, what are some examples? What kind of thing are you talking about?
Well, let's see. So far, I've gotten one product on my in the mail. It's called the ThighPad. It's basically it's an iPad.
Oh yeah, yeah, I've seen iPhone. That.
Yeah, the guy contacted me through my contact form and sent the product my way. I played with it in the airplane and wrote up a review on it.
So iPads are becoming kind of quite the item for pilots, right? So what are you seeing?
I mean, it seems like the GA guys have really gone all over, gone all out for it. You've got things like ForeFlight, which is fantastic. I'm sure you guys have already discussed the app. It's got fantastic weather, flight planning, all that business. And now there's about 100 apps that do the same thing to varying degrees of efficiency. You know, the iPhone and the iPad have sort of become like the tricorder in Star Trek, right? It's that thing that you pick up and hold, and it does anything. Any function you need done at this given moment, your iPhone or your iPad does it. And that's a great tool to have in the cockpit.
Now, are there, I don't know, regulatory issues associated with that? Or can you, you know, load her up with an app or the apps you like and off you go?
See, I'm not sure about that at all. Now, I know when it comes down to things like flight planning, there's got to be regulatory issues. I'd be curious to find out about that because I've been developing my own apps under a use-your-own-judgment, make sense sort of disclaimer, much like using an E6B.
Okay, yeah, interesting. I was just curious. So what is your aviation background like? I mean, do you have this fascinating, brilliant story about how you became a pilot or...
My inspirational story.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have one of those, or did you just start flying?
It's both the sort of romantic sort of story, and also just a happy accident. You know, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, just under the approach for 22 left or 22 right or one of the runways, watching all these red-tailed airplanes flying over continuously, and I was fascinated by airplanes and aviation at an early age. And I was lucky enough to be displaced to rural Middle Tennessee pretty young in my childhood, where I somehow convinced my parents to take me to the airport at the age of 13 years old to go on a sample flight lesson. And I never looked back. I just started flying, got into it. I thought I'd just be a private pilot, and I just acquired rating. After rating, after rating, after rating, and I got a phone call from a guy as I was in college, former flight instructor, who asked if I had a multi-engine rating and if I'd like to go fly a Merlin. I said, sure, what's that?
And so off you went.
Off I went, yeah. It's rather a happy accident. I really didn't plan on being a commercial pilot, but I don't think I'd have it any other way.
What part of flying just gets your juices flowing?
My heart's in general aviation. I mean, I know I'm an airline pilot, but I like just going up in, a Cessna or a Piper and just tearing it up. You know, I don't want to have to talk to air traffic control and get permission to turn left. I just want to go left.
Sort of the freedom of the skies?
Yeah, freedom of the skies. A few years ago, I started getting into aerobatics back in Memphis. There was a really fantastic school. If anybody is in the Memphis area, you should go check out the DeWitt Spain Airport. It's right in Memphis on the Mississippi River. There's a guy named Dr. Morris Ray, and the last time I checked, he was charging $145 an hour. That includes his time and wet rental on a 2006, I want to say, Super Decathlon, and he'll take you up and do aerobatics, and that was a whole lot of fun. I really want to get into that and find something like that up here in the New York area.
Now, how much simulation work are you required to do as an airline pilot?
As an airline pilot, it's, they keep changing it at my airline, but we were under a contract where every 6 months we would go in, whether you're an FO or a captain. So you'd go in and take a law line-oriented flight training, which is just like a normal flight. You start at the gate, everything goes normally, and at some point they're going to throw some hiccup at you, be it, a minor caution, something that's going to cause a gate return. Maybe it's wind shear.
Mm-hmm.
It's a normal day at work with bad news. And that's a non-Jeopardy event. It's just a chance for us to go fly with an observer in the back and talk about it. And then we can all learn something as an airline.
I always thought that the guy who, you know, throws the curves in a simulation exercise like that must be a great job, right? You could just say, let's see if he can handle this one, you know, let's throw this at him.
I'll tell you what, I would really enjoy doing that. You know, back when I lived in Memphis, which is where our simulators are based, I really wanted to ultimately wind up there, you know, at the flight safety sim, just to teach, because I really get a good kick out of teaching people and watching that sort of spark go off. And also the sort of sadistic, let's see how they handle this.
Really. Yeah. I don't know. Rob, did you have to do that when you were flying?
Remember when you said something about, boy, it must be fun. You can throw all these things at people. And do you know what? Anybody that teaches, even at the basic level, realizes that if you throw enough distractions at somebody, they're going to melt down. There's only so much that a person can take. Some can Absolutely. Take more than others. And the reason that they always told us never to try that stuff was that you never knew when the day was going to come that the situation could be reversed. And the guy that you had given a really bad ride to was going to be up there evaluating you in some way. And boy, were you going to get paid back. So we never did that stuff. Although there were some guys that I you know, at flight safety. Sorry, I didn't say that today. Some people that I do think I trained with that were pretty, they were pretty demanding.
By the way, Pat.
Yes.
I have a totally random question. I'm not sure if our listeners will care about this, but I learned about this a while back and it fascinated me. So the cool thing, because you fly the CRJ-200, and the thing I always like about either being a passenger in one or even just sitting at the airport watching arrivals about the CRJ-200 is how, I'm not sure if dive bomb is the right word, but basically how you guys flare very, very, very late on approach. And can you explain why that is?
Yeah, it's the lawn dart approach. But you'll notice it's only on the CRJ-200. The 700s and 900s don't do it, do they?
I've heard that the 200 does not have slats, whereas the 700 and 900 do.
Absolutely. No slats on the airplane. It flies just like a Cessna. You know, you point it straight down at the runway, fly down the glide slope. And I mean, the landing technique on the plane is remarkably simple. It's, you know, you've got the automated height above terrain calls where it calls you 100. And we just start pulling the power back at 50, make sure it's down to idle. And in the flare, when it makes a 20-foot call, you flare it pitch level and wait for the runway. And it'll almost always give you a relatively smooth landing right near the 1,000-foot marks in a no-wind condition, ideal simulator conditions.
Pat, maybe for the benefit of our listeners who are not pilots, we could make this sort of a teaching moment. And why don't you explain just exactly what the slats are and how they contribute to the aircraft?
Well, sure. The slats are a surface very similar to the flaps, except they're on the forward edge, the leading edge of the wing. So when you apply slats and flaps, you're physically changing shape, the actual curvature of the wing. Slats go down in the front, flaps go down in the back. The wing increases its curve and allows the airplane to generate more lift. And more lift means you can actually fly at a slower speed. It just lets us fly slower, land slower, and therefore eat up less distance on the runway.
And so the CRJ-200 doesn't have slats. Why does it not have slats when the others do?
I don't know specifically why it doesn't have the slats, but the CRJ-200 was initially developed straight from the Canadair Challenger business jet. And it's, you know, there's a lot more that went into it than this, but they didn't do a whole lot more than stretch out the airplane. And I believe they put slightly bigger engines on it for the CRJ-200. There's not a whole lot of serious changes. Now, once you get into the CRJ-700 and 900, they started really cleaning it up for airline use, and they applied FADEC, which really decreases the workload on your thrust levers. Mm-hmm. They put the slats on the leading edge, and they did a whole lot of fantastic work with the environmental control system, which is much to be desired on the 200s.
Are they mechanical slats or gravity feet?
I don't know how the slats work on that airplane. If I had to guess, I'd say they're electric because the flaps on the 200 are electric.
See, ha, bet you folks didn't know I knew all that.
I know, I'm kind of impressed.
Yeah, for whatever it's worth, too, I flew the 604 and the 605 Challengers, and from which the 200 was derived, and they land just the same way. I mean, no slats, and you do exactly the same thing. You know what I think is interesting, Pat, and maybe you, I don't know if you ever thought of this, but I wonder how they learned how to land an airplane like that, because I would have thought that the test pilots would have tried to fly it a little more normal, but... And then they, I don't know, would they end up at 50 feet running out of airspeed going, whoa, man, it ain't going to work. I don't know. I just wondered about that. Yeah. Well, anyway.
I don't know.
How do you land a Learjet?
Carefully?
Very carefully. I think you don't have much of a choice. Typically, your VREF speed in almost any airplane is going to be, what 1.3 VREF?
That's right.
I think. So if you fly that airplane in at 1.3 VREF, you are nose down. Here's the problem with the airplane, is at least with the CRJ-200, and I imagine the Challenger is a little bit worse, is once you get down into ground effect, the airplane will float all day, even if you carry 5 knots of extra airspeed.
No.
So I think the landing technique, if you want to put it down on the 1,000-foot mark, that's more or less the only way you're going to do it, unless you want to drop below ref, which is not advisable.
Are there other airplanes that you'd just love to fly? Is there something that you'd like to... I don't want to say move up to, but is there something different that you'd love to try?
Well, yeah, I'd move up. I don't know if move up is the right word. I really want to fly a Piper Cub. Yeah.
Well, if it's more fun, if it's more enjoyable or more fun, that's a move up.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm a big fan of business aviation. I love all the biz jets and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, put me in one of those small Learjets and let me rock it up at, 8,000 foot a minute like some of them do when they're sure, cool. I'm all for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, Pat, let me ask, as long as you're talking about other airplanes, I meant to ask you when I saw that story on your blog, I don't know, last month sometime about the P-51. Now, that wasn't you in the P-51 out at Reno.
Oh, no, I wish. I'd love to.
Oh, okay. I just wondered. I was going to say, wow, this is pretty cool.
Yeah. No, that was a video I found on the internet. That's another new thing that I've been doing on the blog is when I find something that's just really, really cool, I post it on the blog so other people can find it. Yeah, it's a joyride in the P-51 Mustang. Look for that at aviationchatter.com. It's cool.
Sounds great. Yeah.
Yeah, and if anybody out there has a P-51 and wants to give me a ride, we can put cameras in that and post it on the blog.
Ooh. See, that's what you could have done, though, is you could have said, well, actually, it was me in the back. I was taking the video.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's why you can't see me.
Yeah, I get a little...
Oh, sure, lie. Right. Come on, you're a pilot. Nobody believes you anyway. Come on.
Absolutely.
And you're supposed to be shallow, too. So, come on, you have a reputation to live down to here.
Yes.
Pat, besides aviationchatter.com, where can folks find you online? You're on Twitter, I think?
Yeah, you can look me up. I'm at Pat Flanagan on Twitter.
Is there anything that you wanted to bring up that we didn't talk about?
Yeah, I'd like to throw a plug in for a new project I just put together. It's my very first iPhone app. It hit the App Store on, July 10th, I believe. Hmm. It's called Hold Here. And it's my answer to the old bug out time problem.
And now, did you do the development on this yourself?
Did it all start to finish. I was actually a computer science minor back in college.
That's handy.
So, yeah, the whole idea came to it coming flying into JFK, actually.
Yeah.
We're constantly given holding patterns. And one of the things that you need to do when you're going into a holding pattern that flight instructors don't teach their instrument students is you need to calculate how long you can hold before you're looking at an actual fuel situation.
Oh, huh.
You don't think about it, but if you're holding at this fix, you're sitting there burning gas at the same rate you would as if you're flying towards the airport, but you're making zero progress.
Right.
So how long can we hold before we have to bug out and head off to the alternate airport, or worse, go someplace else?
So bug out, that's a technical term.
Yeah, it's borrowed from military term.
Ah, okay. And so this application, this app, does that calculation for you, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
The math is fairly simple. But I'll tell you what, when you're bouncing around in turbulence and you're talking to approach control and trying to plan where you're going to go, you get task saturated and it's not so simple.
Hmm.
So I sat there looking at my FMS in the airplane thinking, you know, why doesn't this thing tell me exactly how long I can hold? Why do I have to do all this extra junk? And I realized I had a computer in my pocket that could. It was just waiting for a program to be written.
Is it called Bug Out? I mean, is that where we'd find it on the iTunes?
No, it's called Hold Here because once I put it together, I decided, you know, while I'm dealing with holding patterns, I may as well take it the next logical step. So I put together a simple holding pattern entry calculator. It's really intuitive. All you do is take two fingers and spin the dial to set your inbound and outbound course for the actual hold. And then there's a button to let you spin the dial and set your aircraft heading. And it shows you precisely how you're going to fly the entry, the recommended FAA entry to the hold.
Interesting.
It has a word of caution that says you're solely reliable for your own actions.
Yeah, so exactly.
Are you a Republican? Is that the... I just wondered.
All right, very good. Pat, thanks again for joining us.
Great. Well, thank you.
All right, next up, this is a recording that Rob made from Oshkosh. Rob, you were playing with the guys from General Electric, I guess, right?
Maybe we could rephrase that a little bit.
I didn't think of it that way. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, actually, Max, this was I was sort of prodded into this by Dan. Not that he did it on purpose, but he spoke a number of times during AirVenture about this cool game that the GE folks had put together called Terminal. Terminal Challenge. Dan, what was it called again?
Dan's the name going. Of the game was Terminal Command.
I know.
He asked me.
I just wanted to see if you. So it was called Terminal Command, and it's really a pretty cool game in which you get to play sort of ramp master at a major airport with airplanes coming and going, and you've really got to decide when things need to be done to keep things flowing. And so I heard that Dan had been back many, many times, and I wanted to make sure that I had my chance before we left. And so I went over to the building where the software was and met up with Neil Siddons there from GE. And, of course, that was after we had already spoken to all their cool social media ladies, Aiden and Audrey. And so they were already gone, so I was kind of stuck talking to Neil. But, well, that's okay. So we had a good time anyway, and that's kind of what this whole thing is about. I went in there to all set to kick Dan's butt. And this is what happened.
Jetwine.com. It's time for another edition of Jetwine.com, the international blog of aviation buzz and bold opinion. Jetwine is brought to you in part by a grant from Cessna Aircraft Company. And now from our studio in Chicago, here's the man with an opinion on all things aviation, Jetwine editor Rob Mark.
Hi, it's Rob Mark, and I'm here with the Airplane Geeks / Jetwine at AirVenture 2011. And one of the last, most important aspects of the show, before I leave at least, is to come over and visit my buddies at GE Aviation.
Of course, the GE folks thought I came to hear about all their products, but what I really came to do was play this cool game everybody'd been telling me about.
I just happened to have grabbed Neil Siddons here from the communications department. Neil, maybe you can tell me a little bit about what this whole game is and how it came to be and everything like that.
Yeah, I can, Rob. It's been very popular. You know, when you think of a show like Oshkosh AirVenture, it's really a different audience to every other show. And we wanted to make sure that we reached out to the audience, engaged with them in a different, fun way. So we're promoting some of our innovative technologies, as we always do, but just in a fun and different way. When you're here, we think, well, what are we going to talk about? What are we going to say? Well, we want to say what we're doing around those innovations and the brand and the fact that we're moving away from the commercial engines and embracing also some of the smaller engines, providing systems throughout the aircraft. This terminal command game is just a bit of fun. We really want to promote aircraft health. That's a new technology that we're promoting at the moment that allows you to be proactive with your maintenance. So we're all used to delays and cancellations and reacting to things like, you know, maintenance issues. Wouldn't it be great if we could promote our technology to look ahead? So this game allows you to run the airport and let you see how complex it is to run an airport operation, certainly gate operations. So trying to dispatch aircraft on time, you're trying to handle all the maintenance issues, you're trying to refuel, handle all the passengers. Just a bit of fun to show you how complex it is.
So any idea how many people have played the game since you've been here?
Oh my goodness. I would say we've had thousands through. I mean, literally, it has been nonstop, back to back, from 8 o'clock in the morning to 5, 6 o'clock at night.
Let me ask you a very specific question. You didn't have Dan Webb from the Airplane Geeks here, did you?
I'm familiar with Dan Webb because he has played this game so many times this week. I think he's probably addicted, so he probably needs some help.
So you don't happen to remember what his score was, do you?
Oh, let me think. A wild stab in the dark, 1150.
So if I were to try this game right now, I would have to top 1150 to be better than Dan Webb.
I don't think you have to try hard to beat it. I think you'll do it, Rob.
Oh, Dan is probably cringing right now. Well, Neil, let's go over there and see if we can figure out an opportunity maybe for me to try it. Let's see if I can beat Dan.
Let's do it, Rob. Let's do it.
Here we are. We're going to take command. All right.
Yep.
So I've got to get the exercise. Okay, how it's done, I think you pretty much explained to me what I need to know,
yeah,
right?
I just get to work.
All right, 3, 2, 1. Okay, here we go. And I'm waiting for the first airplane to show up. Here comes a turboprop of some kind. It's pulling into the gate, and it needs maintenance.
Yeah.
So I'm going to drag that over there, and I made 50 points.
Bonus points for the maintenance.
All right, I don't know. Here comes a fighter. Oh, wait, this guy needs something else too. Wait, create a flight plan for this guy. And this guy needs fuel. All right, we'll do that. And he's getting fuel. And here comes a big airplane of some kind. He needs a flight plan too. Wait, I'm going to drag that over here. Okay. He doesn't need anything yet. Here comes another big Air Force airplane. Let's see, he needs fuel, so we'll drag some gas over here. And this guy needs gas. Oh my gosh, I'm already behind. Get to work. I'm promoted to station manager. Take that, Dan Webbage. All right, sorry. All right, we're waiting for that. I'm up to 210. Dan's probably getting nervous.
Let's go back.
Of course, what Neil cleverly left out of the instructions he gave me was the fact that I was going to be expected to manage more than one airport at the same time, not to mention multiple annoying, demanding aircraft.
You're at the terminal.
Oh, you mean I have to keep track of them both at the same time? Do I have to stay on this while he's fueling, or can I go back to municipal? Okay. This guy doesn't need anything yet. Go back to municipal. Oh, I see. That tells you things that need to be done. He needs a flight plan. This guy, we can't do any fuel, but we can. Oh, okay. We'll do that. And this guy needs some. He needs to depart, so we'll take him over there. And there are four things going on the municipal side. Let's see, this guy needs some. He wants to depart, so let's get rid of him. Always good to get rid of him. This guy needs to get cleaned. This guy needs some car. Going. This guy needs some gas. So must have done okay anyway. And then Neil tossed one more roadblock in front of me. Passenger mood. See, what are the passengers? Who cares about the passengers? Oh, you mean I'm supposed to care about the passengers?
That's it.
Oh, my gosh. You mean I made the people so mad that they didn't want to come back?
Thank you.
All right. I can do this better. Can I have one more chance?
Let's play again.
Okay. We have an audience here, too. All right. I'm ready. Look at passenger mood is excellent. Okay. I'm going to keep these guys happy this time. Here comes a fighter. Can't believe anybody cares what fighter pilots think. But that's another story. Okay. He needs to create a flight plan. I took care of him very quickly, so he'll probably be happy. Here comes a big Air Force guy. He needs gas. I'll take care of him very quickly. There we go. That'll keep them happy. One other thing. Oh, this guy needs gas, but I can't get him gas because this guy is still refueling. And now here comes another one. Oh, get gas for this guy. Okay, mood is still good. I haven't won any points. We'll get him a flight plan. The mood is still good. Now, this is my second chance at station manager, so we'll see if I can make the people happier this time. I'm up to a bold 160 points. Oh, right. I knew that. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Ooh. Well, that means he's mad.
Yeah.
Ooh. Oh, I didn't know that. All right. See, now Dan would catch that and we'd get rid of this guy. Of course, no matter what I did, the two 13-year-old kids that were looking over my shoulder just could not imagine how I'd survived the game as long as I had already. No groaning. The audience is groaning here. I don't understand it. I mean, one more. What do they need? Fuel, right. Okay, fuel. He's mad. This military guy's kind of cranky, isn't he? Let's get this guy some cleaning. We'll get this guy some gas. And this guy needs some food, all right? And that guy wants to get out or needs flight plan. Okay, we'll get him going. This guy needs food too, but we can't do that. Oh. What are they unruly about? Quick, what am I... Okay, I'll get him some food for this guy. And what's the... Man, these guys... These people... Okay, well, I can still do this. What do you mean passenger mood fare? These people have no patience. I mean, don't they understand what we're doing here? We'll do some of that. We'll get this guy some fuel. There we go. Oh, this guy's red. Oh, my God. His handling of passengers are mad. We'll create a flight plan for this guy. Oh, who wants to depart? Somebody wants to depart with that guy. Okay, all right. I'm going. Oh, my God. The passenger mood's getting worse. We got to get this guy some... prepare the cabin. This guy wants to depart. Passenger. What is with... There's obviously something wrong with this game, Neil.
You know what it is? You need GE's IVHM technology to help you out.
And look, I think I did better than Dan, didn't I?
I think you did half as good, looking at the score.
All right. I think it's time to let somebody else just get in there and just impress me. So, see, and actually, that's the other reason I had trouble, is that I was getting heckled from the audience.
That's right. That's
and
unfair.
I was under a lot of pressure.
That's unfair. It's a lot of pressure in aviation, Rob.
You know, it's a very interesting game. So, listen, thank you so much. And, you know, we're really glad that you came to AirVenture 2011 this year. Do you think you'll have this game and who knows what maybe next year?
I think we'll have something new. I hope we'll have more technology to share and more fun and exciting things to do and more social media things happen.
So then maybe it would behoove me to get in here a little sooner so I can beat the pants off Dan Webb, huh?
We'll send you a copy of the game early so you can practice, Rob. How about that?
Yeah, but you weren't supposed to say that where Dan could hear it. Well, Neil, thank you so much for your time today. And for the Airplane Geeks and Jetwine from AirVenture 2011, I'm Rob Mark.
Well, so much for that GE Terminal Command game. At least until next year.
Jetwine.com is brought to you in part by Cessna Aircraft Company at Cessna.com. Jetwine.com.
Well, you know, that was actually a lot of fun, though. What it reminded me of, you could hear me getting a little crazy, was back to the days when I used to be an air traffic controller, and we'd work approach control during a rush, and it would be just like that. Where are they going? What are they doing? These people are just... It was just like that. So it brought back many very cruel memories.
So, Pat, you've played this game?
Well, yeah. I just went over to your blog, jetwine.com, and I clicked the link for Terminal Command. They've got a demo on the website. It's addictive.
It is. You know, it really is. I played it quite a few times since last week. We should tell everybody, it's a good point that you made there, Pat. I mean, if they go up to, they can go to jetwine.com and find the link, or it's up on the GE site. In future flight segment, I can't give you the exact URL. We'll put it in the show.
www.ge.com/the-GE-show/future-flight. I think jetwine.com is a lot easier to remember.
All right, great.
You know, I like this guy, Pat. He's quite the marketing guy.
He's helping you out, isn't he?
Yeah, he certainly is, unlike some other members of the group.
Well, yeah. One other guy that we like is David Vanderhoof, and I think he's got his This Week in Aviation History segment for us right now. So listen carefully. David, take it away.
Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 3, Episode 22, August 7th through the 13th. August 7th, 1953. William Bill Bridgman becomes the first man to pilot an aircraft to 1.88 Mach, or 1,357 miles per hour. The aircraft he achieved it in was one of the unsung heroes of supersonic flight, the D-558-2, the Douglas Skyrocket.
The XS-1, or eventually called the X-1, was the Air Force's successful attempt at flying supersonic. Okay, well, the F-86 was, but that's another story. The U.S. Navy contracted Douglas Aircraft to develop a series of high-speed test aircraft. The result was the E-558 Skystreak. Skystreak was a jet-powered, straight-winged aircraft. Three D-558s were built, and they completed 224 flights. They achieved 0.99 Mach in level flight and supersonic in a dive. The Navy then had Douglas create the DD-582. The Sky Rocket had a 35-degree swept wings and was both capable of having a rocket motor or jet engine. The X-1 was always rocket-equipped. Skyrocket would become the first aircraft to fly at Mach 2. The Navy originally intended there be a follow-on, the DD-583, but that was canceled by the NACA and the Navy. August 9, 1884, Charles Renard and Arthur Krebs pilot the La France, a war dirigible. The La France was the first controllable airship. The aircraft made seven flights, five of which returned to the starting point. Interestingly enough, the technology used to propel the La France has become new again. The 8-kilometer round trip used a 535-kilogram battery, powering electric motors to drive propellers. The flight lasted 23 minutes, so what is old is now new again. August 11, 1939, Pan American World Airways begins using its new Boeing B-314 Clipper to fly from New York to Southampton, England for regular passenger service. The Boeing 314 could carry 74 passengers with a crew of 8. There were separate dressing rooms for both men and women. The wing was large enough to be able to walk out to one of the 1,500 Wright double cyclones to service them in flight. The B-314 cruised at a whopping 175 miles per hour or 152 knots. The cost of this flight at the time was $375, or, adjusted for inflation, $6,100. Of course, that number was generated before the S&P downgraded the U.S. to AA+. And our last bit of trivia, the B-314 didn't have a cockpit. It had a bridge, like all good ships. August 11, 1986, G-Lynx, the Westland Helicopters Company demonstrator, was piloted by Trevor Eggington. G. Lynx was a WG-13-800, otherwise known as a Lynx AH-1. The helicopter, with its upgraded engines and a semi-rigid rotor, broke the 15 and 25-kilometer course records by achieving a 487 kilometers per hour or 249 miles per hour. That record, while broken by the Sikorsky X-2, 290 miles per hour, has never been broken. The X-2 was never flown in a sanctioned attempt by the FAI, or the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, who maintains those records. And last, one for Robert. August 13, 1991. Midway Airlines files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The decline of Midway Airlines was not due to a certain airplane geek's piloting skills. It was, in fact, the purchase of the Eastern Airlines hub at Philadelphia International Airport in 1990. They could not keep up with the then powerhouse of U.S. Airways. The second factor was the huge inflation of aviation fuel during the first Persian Gulf War. So despite ongoing rumors that it was Rob's Mark's fault, note the guilty look in some recent photos at Oshkosh, it really wasn't. And lastly, a correction. There seems to be a perception that I am unstumpable. Not sure if that's actually a word. However, I misspoke when speaking about Betty Jo, the P-82 Twin Mustang. She does not hold the record for a round-the-world flight. She does hold the record for the fastest propeller flight from Hawaii to New York nonstop, 5,551 miles, done in 14 hours and 32 minutes. It would have been faster, but the pilot never dropped off 3 to 4 drop tanks, and he landed with them in New York. Sorry, Jamie, but the excitement of being in Wisconsin for Oshkosh was just too overwhelming. I lost my head. And this week's first flights that occurred during the week of August 7th through the August 13th. This week's a big list. August 7th, 1928, the Curtiss Model 50 Robin. August 7th, 1941, Grumman Aircraft's the TBF Avenger. August 7th, 1951, the McDonnell Aircraft F3H Demon. August 8th, 1982, Cessna's 208 Caravan. August 9th, 1956, Fiat's G91 Pan Jet Fighter. August 11th, 1955, Bell's XV5 Tilt Rotor. August 11th, 1972, one of my favorite aircraft and one that was resplendent in VFC 111 colors at Oshkosh this weekend, the Northrop F-5E Tiger II. August 12th, 1965, the Learjet 25. And last but not least, August 13th, 1976, the Bell 222, otherwise known as Airwolf. And that's the way it was, August 7th through the 13th. This is David M. Vanderhoof, the Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Couple of things.
Yes, Dan.
Well, I believe, I'm not sure if this is correct, but I remember reading somewhere that because of the Pan Am Clippers, that is where we started, some of the nautical terminology started flowing over to aviation in terms of calling, you know, calling people captains and first officers and such, and why you started seeing the epaulets on uniform shirts and such. So I'm not sure if that's true, but that's
believable.
Yes. Though.
Well, it also was the fact that they were flying airships long before they were flying airplanes, and airships always had bridges, Dan. Yes. Though Pan Am took the nautical themes to the nth degree.
Anyway, though David missed something.
This week he missed something?
Yes.
I hope you're ready for this, David.
No, because in the past, a little bit more than a week, the aviation world did lose a great historian.
This is true, Reggie? Yeah.
Yeah. So, R.E.G. Davies. Granted, I only have one of his books, but a very famous historian, a curator at the Air and Space Museum. I would say perhaps the most famous airline historian ever.
You are absolutely correct.
Yes.
Well, can I add something here, though? I of course, do appreciate the tactful way you describe the Midway Airlines bankruptcy, David. Thank you again for not bringing up my record with the carrier, which quite a few actually point to as the reason for the Chapter 11. I never agreed with that. But seriously, of course, we didn't shut down in August. That was just the first nail in the coffin. But boy, I got to tell you, I think the actual day is coming up in mid-November. But boy, these next 4 months, oh my God, it was bad. It was really bad.
Well, I said they filed for Chapter 11.
No, I know. I'm just saying, but I just didn't know if the listeners would understand that didn't mean that we didn't stop operating that day. It didn't come. The actual closed out didn't happen for another 4 months.
Okay. Normally now we do the Australia Desk report, but we don't really, really have an Australia Desk report. Unless,
yay!
Well, we have managed to track down Steve Vischer. Steve, you got about 30 seconds. Do you have any kind of a report for us?
Well, seeing as I've been worshipping at the feet of Leo Laporte all day, not really.
Hi, Steve. Steve's in California. Steve is still in the U.S. When do you return to Australia?
I'm leaving in a couple of days. I've just got to get back to Chicago, pick up Simba, and I'll be on my way.
Very good. Well, listen, Grant did send in a couple of items. He says that Tiger continues to be grounded, and he says more Super Hornets have arrived. So there's the shortest Australia desk we've ever had.
Well, I can't really trump that. They must be getting close to the full complement of Super Hornets now. They'll be getting pretty close to the full number. I think they were getting 24, if memory serves.
Ah.
So that's a good thing. And Tiger Airways, you know, I'm surprised that that's – if they're still grounded, I would be shocked, to be honest, if they make it back up into the air.
It's been so long.
Yeah, there's been a history of this. There was an airline back in the late 80s, early 90s in Australia that started up called Compass. And Compass Airways, they started off using MD-80s or something similar to that. They only lasted a few months and they went bankrupt. Then they came back and they were using A300, 600s, and they lasted an even shorter amount of time. Tiger Airways, I would have to say, they've lasted longer, obviously, than that airline did. But, you know, I just don't think Australia really has the population to support that many airlines. I really, I mean, there's not that many people here, you know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's a small market.
I've been. I'm at the end of a 3 week trip here to the United States. It's been a magic experience, but I've got to tell you, I'm exhausted. I need to go home.
Yeah, no doubt. All right. Well, it's nice to talk to you.
I think Rob and I both have to say you are now to import Tim Tams to North America on a monthly, if not weekly basis, because now you've got two attics, one in Chicago and one in Pennsylvania.
Awesome. And David, I noticed you didn't partake of the Vegemite at any stage at Oshkosh, so that means I don't have to touch Dr. Pepper.
Oh, good. Lucky for you.
Yeah, thanks, Max. It's horrible.
Thanks for calling in,
hasta
Steve.
Hasta la vega. Oh, no, yeah. That's not it.
It's
no,
hasta la vista, baby.
I will talk to you back when I'm back in the land of metric measurement and right-hand drive.
Very good. Thanks, Steve.
See you guys.
Bye. And now here's Peter Johnson, across the pond.
Here's a view from across the pond.
This week on Across the Pond, we look at the UK airport infrastructure and some local news issues. A while ago, we discussed the issues faced by London Heathrow Airport in its drive to be more competitive. The government has refused the third runway, and with demanding noise restrictions, there doesn't seem to be any place for the operator, BAA, to go to increase growth and revenues. Why, Heathrow is not the only South East England airport that's been in the news recently. Its arch rival, London Gatwick, which was recently sold after the Competition Commission forced BAA to divest it, has also been looking at its growth and competitive opportunities. We've also seen plans published for yet another River Thames Estuary Airport this week, and even Southend Airport has got some press coverage. Gatwick, like its cousin Heathrow, has plans for an extra runway to develop passenger and air traffic growth, and this has been quashed by the incoming government. Gatwick, like its cousin Heathrow, had plans for an extra runway to develop passenger and air traffic growth, but this was squashed by the incoming government, and it has had to rely on organic growth. Plans to grow passenger traffic from 32 million to 40 million by 2020 and up to as high as 45 million after that can only be achievable with that extra runway. Gatwick's chief executive, Stuart Wingate, believes that Gatwick is well placed for the future, though. Its single runway is the busiest in the world, and he's already stretched its capacity to 53 flights per hour, and he's planning to stretch it even further to 55. But he warns the government that the airspace in the southeast is now at capacity, and an urgent change of focus is required. Wingate should watch out, though, because Gatwick's largest operator, EasyJet, has just started operating flights from what is now known as London Southend Airport.
It's an exciting day for EasyJet today as our tickets go on sale for our first flights from London Southend Airport.
Situated on the edge of the River Thames, this privately owned airport has just had a new railway station built with direct links to central London and has benefited from other new infrastructure, including a new control tower. EasyJet is planning 70 flights a week and plans for passenger traffic of around 2 million per annum by 2020. The Olympics will be a great test for all the southeast airports, and some pundits are betting that London Southend will be the winner because it's less congested, it's got less congested taxiways and hard stands, and it has a 15-minute flight to train passenger experience. It's not all Wanderer knew this, though, with the BBC recently describing the terminal as being more, and I quote, black coffee and full English breakfast rather than international transport hub, unquote. Southend, too, needs a runway extension, and its plans are being challenged by local residents who want to be no part in the increased air traffic in the area. Just along the River Thames from Southend comes yet another estuary airport plan this week, this time being promoted by the famous architect Lord Foster, who recently built the new Hong Kong airport. He said it would allow London to compete with rapidly expanding airports in Europe and the Middle East. The arguments are extraordinarily persuasive, and the precedents are also compelling. More than 10 years ago, Hong Kong built what was then the world's largest airport, on an island reclaimed from the sea, and it took just 4 years.
The tranquil setting of the Northwood Hill Nature Reserve on the Isle of Grain, just one of the many along the north coast of Kent, is today peaceful. The only sounds, bird call, and the rush of wind across the marshes. But it could soon be very different.
Thank you.
London's Mayor Boris Johnson says he wants to put an airport off the Isle of Sheppey.
So, as the airports in the southeast fight it out for airport growth, some regional airports are calmly, organically growing and mopping up the overspill. One such airport is Liverpool's John Lennon Airport, owned and operated by Vancouver Air Services. It's seen a fivefold increase in passengers in 10 years and plans to see this continue. I recently met the new managing director, who had some very interesting ideas for growth, one of which is to maximise the opportunity for new aircraft technology. For example, the Boeing 787 will be able to operate from its 7,500-foot runway to almost anywhere in the world, and the reliance on the southeast for these services will diminish. Some of you may have recently seen the tragic news of an aircraft incident out of Barton Airfield near Manchester in England. What I can say is that we all send our condolences to the pilot's family and wish the passenger a swift recovery. What I'd like to say, though, is that our very own Steve Cook, who flies from Barton, is safe and well. Steve, who was a guest on our programme a short while ago and an avid Airplane Geeks follower, is, of course, also the voice behind the Flying Podcast. He assures me he'll be back behind the mic very soon to record some more material. He's just very busy at the moment. And finally, the Dutch newspaper De Telegraaf is reporting that Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport has a new unofficial service being offered. Apparently, prostitutes are taking advantage of cheap air travel to fly into the airport from Eastern Europe. They then pick up their travellers and take them to a budget hotel, execute their trade before jumping back on a plane to fly home. The Amsterdam Prostitution Association told Radio Netherlands they can earn a lot of money and much more than they can in their own countries, quote unquote. You can't really make this stuff up, but when there's a buck to be made, I suppose someone's going to exploit it. Cheap flights have a lot to answer for. For future Across the Pond news segments, we'd like to encourage some of our listeners to participate. So if you'd be interested in joining me as a guest on a news segment in the future, then email the show. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from Across the Pond.
Right, thank you, Peter. I know Peter's been working on getting some more new guests for future episodes of Across the Pond, so we'll look forward to those. Thanks again, Peter. Moving on to listener mail. Once again, we have quite a bit of listener mail. First one comes from Paul Filmer. Now, Paul, of course, is a past guest and one of the better aviation photographers we've seen. In response to last episode's discussion of the Dust Up TV show, Paul sent some photos, first of him from 1991 with his PA-25 Hutchinson conversion back in Oklahoma. And he also sent some newer photos of some agricultural aviation planes. Most are turboprops these days, he says. He's got a photograph of an Ayers S2R Thrush Commander in Idaho. He's got a number of photos, and we'll put the link to those in the show notes. They're really dramatic. Paul's work is really fantastic. So go take a look at the show notes. Look for the link to Paul's photos. We also heard from Scott Hardy. Now, he's the director of a documentary film that's coming titled Volantor. Now, this is about Paul Moeller, who is kind of an interesting guy, but he's been trying to build a flying car for quite a number of years. And this film is going to document that, I think, his adventures in trying to create the Volantor sky car. Scott also mentions that they're looking for donations from fans and enthusiasts to help make this film possible. And you can find out more about that at www.indiegogo.com/Volantor. That's IndieGogo.com/VolAntor. Chris writes in. He says he's just finished listening to episode 157. He said he found the conversation about the differences of the cost of flying in the U.S. and Australia really interesting. He says he lives in the U.K., just started his PPL, so training in the U.S. was something I seriously considered. He as the guys from the Ozdesk were saying, flying outside of the U.S. is an expensive game. And we've heard this over and over. Rob, you'd sort of concur with that, right? The U.S. is kind of the cheapest place to come if you want to learn to fly.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, we unfortunately, we take that for granted as people certainly are not used to paying $150, $175 an hour for an airplane these days. But the good news is that it's a lot less expensive than it is in Europe or, as Stephen Grant said, down by them.
Now, Chris mentions an interesting thing, that there's an aerodrome that's close to his flight school, and they've started a fixed fee kind of model. They charge, he says, around £25 per day. But with that, you can make as many touch and goes as you like, obviously a much cheaper alternative. We got a voicemail from Stephen Tornblum.
Good morning, gentlemen. It's 10:48 Pacific Standard Time in the morning. It's Stephen out in California, and for once, I'm not calling you at 4 in the morning. How do you like that, Rob Mark? Anyway, oh, speaking of Rob, that's why I was calling. I heard from a little birdie that the pins or buttons and the original artwork print or posters that I had brought with me to Oshkosh somehow ended up on a dashboard of an RV instead of in the hands of Steve, Grant, Aunt Benet, Dan, David, and Max. Just wondering what happened there. A little too much Jeremiah League, bro? Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and try to locate some new buttons, and I'll get some new posters, and I will be actually sending the stuff to Mr. Webb to assure that the distribution and delivery will occur to everybody else. Well, maybe you too, Mark, but that depends if Dan wants to be nice, I guess. But anyway, so I will get some new stuff for all of you guys and the Aussies since you guys all missed out. And with that, I wanted to let you know 158 was a good episode. I loved it. And the outtakes were great, especially the Dan doing who's a good podcaster, who's a good podcaster. And yeah, that ranks probably one of the best outtakes I've heard in a long time. So that had me laughing here. Anyway, I'll let you go, and look forward to the next episode. And hopefully next year we can all get together again at Oshkosh. Or if you guys are going to go to Fun and Sun, maybe we could. I think I'm going to plan on being at Fun and Sun next year if you guys are going to do it. Anyway, talk to you later. Take care. Have a good day.
Okay, let's just get a few things straight.
Yeah.
First of all, it wasn't a little birdie, Stephen. You know it was that little snitch, Dan, that called you to tell you that I made a slight little mistake. So I...
Did you ever find this stuff?
No, actually, I didn't.
Okay. Oh, well, Stephen, thanks for sending that in, and we'll... I don't know what to make of it. I really don't.
Well, I think we should talk about the fact that Dan was a little snitch.
We also heard from John. Now, this is, again, on blocked seats. We've been talking about weight and balance. And maybe
no,
Pat's
I really wish I had never even brought this up.
It just will not go away. Well,
is lasting longer than the whole damn tanker program.
Yeah. John says he has another explanation for the blocked seats on the 737-800. It can be possible to dispatch an airliner even if one emergency exit is unusable, for example, due to an inoperative emergency slide. Usually the exit has to be marked as unusable and total passenger numbers have to be reduced. He says, I have no experience in the 737-800, but on the A380, which I currently fly, it looks like this. According to the minimum equipment list, 2 out of 16 emergency exits can be unusable for a maximum of 5 flights if certain seats are blocked.
A couple of very quick things.
Yeah.
A, number one, it's really cool that we have a real A380 pilot emailing us.
Yes.
Secondly...
What's that giggling in the background?
I hear it too.
I hear that.
But secondly, I guess it just when you hear like 16 exits...
I know, isn't that amazing?
Appreciate, yeah. But then the other thing that interests me. Is this has to? I'm guessing this probably varies by whether it be FAA, EASA, or whoever, how the number of exits is determined. I'm not sure if it's a function of the number of seats, or I think there's also like a minimum evacuation. There was a maximum evacuation time.
Yes,
rather.
Yes, and they test for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Interesting
typically
stuff.
Typically something small, like 90 seconds or 120
seconds.
It's not
long, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pat, on your airplane, do you do any weight and balance by moving passengers around?
Yeah, we've got it all spaced out by zones. There's a total of 6 zones, and we just punch in our weight and balance based on where they're sitting. Sometimes we've got to pick up a passenger up and move all the way to the back. I'm not sure if that's what you're asking about, though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it just started when we were talking about a particular airline leaving seats open as a means for, achieving weight and balance.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, sometimes we have to do that. The CRJ is notoriously, at least the 200 off balance, we always have to remove people from the front rows and move them all the way to the back.
Oh, huh.
In fact, we're really bad if we have to take a jump seater. Because then we have to add ballast to the back of the airplane to accommodate
good.
A jump seater.
Yeah.
And how do you tell the people that are in the front that they must move to the back? You avoid saying anything like it has nothing to do with your shape or anything like that, right?
Very judiciously. Now, the flight attendant handles that, and it's not an issue. And, of course, they can get up and move back to the front if it's smooth in flight. It's just for the takeoff and landing is where we're really concerned.
Okay. We had another email this is from Steve, the Pueblo spotter. He says, it seems that weight and balance has taken over the tanker as the most discussed topic on the show. Just like you said, David. But he also says, perhaps David should find something on how to balance a tanker. Now, that would be interesting. Steve says, with that said, after hearing about this, I dug through my stack of airline magazines and found an article in American Way by the CEO, Gerard Opry, who's also a pilot, he mentions, on the subject of weight and balance and how American figures out the data. We're running long. I was going to try to paraphrase that a little bit, but it's actually a really interesting description of how American does that. So rather than take up the time here, we'll just put the link to this article in the show notes. And really, even if you're only just sort of mildly interested in this, take a look. It's pretty interesting.
And then, of course, send David a question.
Yes, that's right. A new question. We heard from Owen Zupp. Owen says, I'm another Aussie who just started listening to your podcast through listening to Plane Crazy Down Under, where I've done a few interviews from time to time. I now have even more to blame Grant and Steve for, as before I met them, I was happy in my Luddite world where I thought a podcast was a form of fly fishing. It says, keep up the great work, and hopefully I'll make it to Oshkosh next year. So, great to hear from Owen. Oh, Owen's got a site you can check out. It's www.thereandback.com.au. So, you can check out Owen's site. We have a voicemail from Bill.
Hello, airplane geeks. This is Bill from Victoria. That's YYJ on your favorite aviation chart. Wanted to let you know that I enjoyed the road shows lately from Oshkosh and Uvarhazy, and love the Canadian content with the guys from Ice Pilots and lately the guys from Dust Up. And if you want to keep that going, I heard Max mention some love for the Twin Otter. Well, Viking Air here in Victoria has put that Twin Otter back into production, and if you guys get a chance, it would be really neat to hear you interview Dave Curtis, who runs Viking here, and he's done a lot of work on developing the industry here on the West Coast. And just a shout out to Rob, my Jetwine button went flying with me last week, and I'll be keeping that one in my flight bag. Keep up the great work.
And thanks, Bill. And Bill also provided some more detailed contact information for us for Viking, and so we're going to take a look at seeing if we can get those folks on the show. That should be interesting.
Thanks for the nod on the Jetwine button there, Bill.
Cool.
Nicely done. The check is in the mail.
We also heard from Matt. Matt says, hi, guys. As a recent convert to the Airplane Geeks podcast, I just wanted to bring your attention to a project I'm involved in as we're trying to get a bit of publicity for it. Now, this is pretty cool. This is called Save the Trident. This is a small team in the UK, and they're restoring the last complete Hawker Siddeley Trident 1C airliner. He says this is the original smaller model of the aircraft. It has been used as a fire ground trainer, but luckily he says it was never burnt, so it's in relatively good condition. So they've spent a year dismantling and doing the preparation work. He says, we finally moved the fuselage to the Northeast Aircraft Museum at Sunderland. We'll be following this up with the wings and the tail section. Over the next couple of years, we'll be putting the aircraft back together and restoring it completely. Matt says you can read all about the project and where we've got so far on our website, which is www.savethetrident.org. So good luck with that. I love restorations like that. I think that's important to do that. David, do you know anything interesting about this airplane?
It's British. It's a trijet. I really can't say that a Trident I have much information on. It's an airliner. Maybe we should defer to the airline geek. Dan?
If we start going before when I was born, we're going to hit some trouble in terms of history. Okay. So, yeah.
Next up was Aaron. Aaron says, I really enjoy the show each week. I often find myself checking my podcast feed on my BlackBerry looking for the next one. Aaron says, Steve and Grant's comments on user fees were bang on. Here in Canada, the user fees have been creeping up for quite some time. Still nothing like those experienced in Oz, but getting there. Since I don't fly privately anymore, I don't see them, but they're on the rise. And they're right. Once imposed, governments won't reduce or eliminate a fee. He says, I enjoy the airline news and Dan and Rob's commentaries because I often find myself somewhat out of touch with what the airlines are up to.
It's kind of like listening to Dan.
It's kind of like as I'm on the GA side of the fence. Although now that I know Dan wore a pink shirt at AirVenture, I'll always listen to him a little differently.
Correction. I've worn two pink shirts at AirVenture.
You're never going to get away from it. Kudos to David as well for his input on the military side of things. Always interesting. Rob's cool because he likes the Falcon 7X. He says, Aaron says, I fly the 900EX. And Max always does a great job trying to tying everything together and keeping rambling to a minimum.
Though he's failed miserably this episode, folks.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I hope the final version of this is a lot shorter than the actual recording. Now here's the most interesting part. Aaron says that he was able to contact our listener Enrique in Spain because Aaron is a Spanish speaker. You'll recall that Enrique was looking for an English-speaking pilot that he could converse with probably over Skype in order to improve his English speaking. So Aaron has contacted Enrique, and the two are working together to their mutual language skills benefit. So that's really cool. I like that a lot. So thanks for letting us know that, Aaron. Brian wrote in about biofuels. He says they've been mentioned on your show a few times during the August 2nd, this is 2011, episode of the IAG blog podcast. Addison Schoenland interviews Dr. Veronica Persinova, who gives an insight to the promise and limitations of biofuels on airplanes. I found it interesting and informative. Your listeners might be interested. And yeah, it is a good episode, and she's clearly has a lot to say about biofuels and the issues and challenges more broadly than we've discussed on this podcast. So, and you can find the IAG blog podcasts at iagblog.podomatic.com. Bob Iverson writes in, great podcast from Osh, but I'm disappointed. I missed meeting up with any of the geeks, especially the Down Under geeks, Grant and Steve. You should plan to give the UCAP Osh Beer Bust some competition at Osh 12. That may be a good idea. We may have to throw down the gauntlet to those GA guys over at UCAP.
You mean a weed drinking contest?
Yeah, exactly.
Jeremiah weed drinking contest. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Dan, can you help us with that?
Absolutely not.
Okay. All right. One more weight and balance item. This came from David. He's an ex-flight attendant, and he sent a recording.
Hello, airplane geeks. This is David, the former flight attendant. I was listening to your podcast about the 737 weight and balance issues in seats. Rows of seats being blocked off, and just wanted to add how we handled that at my old airline. During the boarding process, after we had all the passengers on board, the flight attendants would have to walk through the cabin and do a passenger count. The aircraft was broken up into three different sections, and you would count how many passengers were in that section of the aircraft and give that to the flight crew. At roughly the same time, the baggage handlers would be giving a bag count to the pilots so the aircraft could did his weight and balance computations. And then prior to departure, we would double-check the passenger numbers and the bag numbers with the gate agent just to make sure everything was on board that was supposed to be on board. We didn't have any extra. We didn't have any less. Anyways, thought I would give that insight to you for how that was handled at our airline. Hope you enjoyed a little bit more information about how that's handled. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
All right. Thank you, David, for sending that in.
Let me say one thing. I just really like that voicemail because at the end, you could tell David was a flight attendant because it was very, yeah. it's like, we know you have a choice in which voicemail you play on the show and we appreciate you. I appreciate you playing me.
Yeah, it was good.
And we hope you enjoyed that voicemail experience and see us again soon.
It was good. I liked it.
I was a little concerned when I first heard it. He said he was an ex-flight attendant and he was talking about weight and balance. And I said, oh my goodness, I hope this isn't the guy, what airline was that from, Dan? The guy slid down the...
Grabbed the beers and pulled the chute.
It's Steven Slater from JetBlue.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Who
yeah.
could forget?
Who could forget?
Especially when he said my old airline. I mean, you don't work there anymore.
Wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. So no, so that was David, not Steven.
Okay, thank you.
One final voicemail. This is from Ian Kershaw.
Good morning, folks. It's Ian Kershaw with a voicemail from Calgary, Alberta, Canada on the morning of August 6th, that Saturday morning. This is a generic voicemail of appreciation that I'd like to share with all of those individuals who contributed to the incredible podcast that I've enjoyed over the past week. I may be ground-based on the wrong side of the fence up here in Calgary, but I got to tell you, having listened to the podcast and wallowed in the enthusiasm and energy that the folks at Uncontrolled Airspace, Plane Crazy Down Under, the Airplane Geeks, and many other folks have produced and shared, no doubt with many hours of effort, I really am mindful of the energy and time that producing the podcast requires, especially at an event like Oshkosh. So whilst I may not have been able to join you, I certainly felt that I was virtually there. It really was first class. The different perspectives, the different styles of the contributions that you all make, the guest interviews, all added up to a very, very enjoyable interlude here and there as I worked through a couple of busy weeks and managed to listen to the different podcasts and interviews over the past almost 10 days now. And the icing on the cake was my email yesterday from Dan with Planista, and I now can enjoy reading his screen-based glossy magazine, which I thoroughly enjoy each and every issue of. So I just wanted to say once again, from north of the border in the frozen, if not snowy north, it's getting chilly in the morning now, to say thank you. Tremendous amount of work went into it all. No banter here from me, no leg pulling, no humor. I just want to say thank you. There was obviously a tremendous amount of work. I could tell from the sound of some of you guys towards the end of the week that you were getting pretty fatigued. We owe you a debt of thanks, and if all the other listeners enjoyed it half as much as I did, your efforts were indeed well rewarded. Thanks again, guys and ladies, for all your efforts. That's Ian Kershaw in Calgary, Alberta. All the best, guys. Bye.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
Thanks, Ian. We really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Yeah. Very, very nice. And, very kind words.
And, you know, he does make a very good point. I mean, when we were up there, of course, you know, all the Airplane Geek guys were up there. But, oh, wait, I don't think you were there, Max. But anyway, the
almost
rest
so.
Of us, it was hard not to notice how much energy everybody brought to their own individual endeavor, whether it was a blog or a podcast or video podcast or whatever they were doing. I mean, people were just, they were going 10, 12 hours a day, flat out, just to get all these cool stories out and back to all the people that couldn't be there. And it is impressive. It really is. And I'm glad that some people notice it.
That's great. Thanks again, Ian. Okay, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest again was Patrick Flanagan from aviationchatter.com. Patrick, again, thank you for joining us.
And thank you.
Tell us your Twitter ID again.
Again, that's twitter.com/PatFlanagan, PatFlanagan.
Also, we'd like to thank Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment. covering European aviation. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. Let's start first with Rob Mark.
Jetwine.com and Jetwine on Twitter, where I am happy to have made a lot of new friends even when I was out in Washington this last weekend. So great times.
And Dan Webb, how about you?
I actually have one challenge before I say where you find me, because I mean to do this. I learned a little bit of trivia a couple weeks ago. So I will send out an Airplane Geeks button to whoever can tell me what is the difference between the Hawaiian Airlines livery on its wide body and narrow body aircraft.
Wow.
So that is a trivia question of the day.
Okay.
Anyway, where you can find me, Twitter, Dan Webbage. Also, you can find me on my blog at thingsinthesky.com.
And at your favorite bar, the Pink Cadillac.
Oh, God.
And David Vanderhoof, where can people find you online?
You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com. I'm trying to get some of the 1,000 pictures or so that I've gotten taken at Oshkosh up, so they should be coming up as the time goes on. I'll leave off the incriminating ones taken of my fellow airplane geeks. And you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof.
Great. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Also at podcastingpassion.com if you're interested in podcasting. In fact, the last episode up, I spoke with Sarah Cagle from the Crew Lounge podcast, which aviation folks might be interested in listening to. And you can also find me at 30,000feet.com. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 159. You'll find links to all the sites we mentioned in the podcast and some other good things, too. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream the podcast right to your mobile phone. If you'd like to send us email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, we have our famous listener line, where you can leave us an audio message. See if Aunt Benet can give us that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at www.brotherloverocks.com. Join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.
I
like the Viper name, though. I think the fact that they named it after my ex-wife, I think that's really cool.
Oh, wow.
And Max, then, don't you be cutting this stuff, because I've had complaints about people telling me that you cut out the ex-wife jokes, and you know, I'm the only one.
I'm just trying to protect you, Rob. Once again, we're here with Platt Flanagan.
Platt Flanagan.
Oh, man.
Sure. Hey, before you go, Pat, David, what the hell are you doing with your hands?
You can see his hands?
Oh, I can hear him doing something.
Oh, he's building a model again.
What do I do every Sunday night? It's the only time I get any modeling done.
Oh. Okay, go back on mute. Pat, talk.
Pat, are you married?
No.
No, you're not. Okay, I was going to say, so then maybe you can give some dating tips to Dan.
Oh, yeah. We flustered Dan.
Crickets.
It's his shirt turning pink, or is it just him? I don't know.
I would just like to say that I am shuddering, but not because of the game thing. I'm just shuddering over the fact, like, how much money did you get for a voiceover guy? like seriously,
how much did I get for a serious voice? Dan, we're running a business here, young man.
Right.
It's the cost of doing business.
Right. I'm glad it's a really accurate voiceover. So, like, from our studio in Chicago. So,
all right,
Rob's office with Simba pretending to be the producer. Here's Rob Mark.
Oh, are you thinking that Steven might get in trouble or something, David?
No, I'm thinking that you come off sounding like a complete ass, and I figured it would.
No. There's a difference between being an ass and being stupid.
That's right. We like asses.
Yeah.
Stupidity we don't stand for.